The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A preview on this hopefully lazy Friday after Thanksgiving. Lazy for the Americans who simply can't face the stores on fearsome Black Friday, that is. Even the sound of that name suggests a belching smokestack of consumption. You might say that while Black Friday symbolizes everything unsustainable on our planet, there is something happening this holiday season that will attempt to point the way toward a more sustainable future. That's right, Americans in Paris, and not only. This hour of The Takeaway is dedicated to the more than 190 leaders and countless other activists and scientists from all over the world who will soon be getting down to business in Paris at the International Summit on Climate Change. It's officially called COP21, the Conference of the Parties. It will, for the first time, try to reach agreement on tangible emission and consumption targets for nations, cities, industries, and other institutions to meet. The targets and goals of COP21 will then be presented and presumably sold to citizens of participating nations who then have to decide how they can make it to Paris, or reach the Paris goals anyway. The summit opens amidst a curious and emotional time for a city that has hosted talks to end wars and to rewrite the borders of nations down through history. Paris is a city still in shock from the November 13th attacks. We reached out to Laura Haim, the chief White House correspondent for the French cable channel Canal Plus. She says Parisians are still committed to the climate summit, but are having a hard time reconciling the urgency of environmental events that happen on a planetary schedule with the urgency of terrorism that snuffed out so many lives in an instant this month.
It was supposed to be an amazing event. It was supposed to be something that all the French people were writing for, to at least try to do something about the climate. It's a very big problem and it's a very big issue in France. So everybody before the attacks was, in a way, happy to have this conference in Paris. And now it's really in the back of their mind.
It's in the back of their mind. The significance of it isn't erased. Do you think that Parisians don't really want the spotlight on Paris right now, don't want to worry about that security right now, would rather worry about their daily lives?
No, it's quite the opposite. Parisians want to have a normal life. And when I speak with, again, my family, my friends, people are telling me, okay, let's do that. Let's create this movement to go to a restaurant. Let's go to a terrace. Let's show to the world that we're not afraid. The climate, however, is a different event because you have a lot of political leaders from all over the world who are coming to the climate conference. So people are saying, it's going to be much more a summit against terrorism than something regarding the climate, at least at the beginning. You have to keep in mind that it's going to be for 11 days, but the first 2 days with all the head of the states coming to Paris, I heard that some of them already want to go to the Bataclan. So the security and the topics are completely focused on safety, security, and tourism in the first 2 days.
And that sense of mourning may actually be reasonable cover for the conference if they don't accomplish all the goals that they want. People won't pay as much attention because the city, again, is focused on other things.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The city is completely focused on other things. And also the city in the middle of the climate conference and the country, they are going to focus on the elections. In the middle of this climate conference, you have the regional election, December 6th and December 13th, with the far right, which is really, really high in the polls with Marine Le Pen. People are extremely, extremely interested and concerned by the rise of the far right, by what's going to happen if the National Front is winning those elections. And it's happening in the middle of the climate conference.
Laura Haim, White House correspondent for the French TV channel Canal Plus. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The Kyoto Protocol was first agreed back in 1997. It required industrialized countries to make specific cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. But developing countries, including big polluters like China, were not forced to cut. In contrast to the Kyoto Protocol, this time around, both developed and developing countries are submitting voluntary pledges to cut their own greenhouse gas emissions, which has raised immediate concerns about how anyone can actually be held to account. Our next guest has been helping a number of governments prepare for the 21st Conference of the Parties, COP21 for short, held this year in Paris. Michael Jacobs is senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate and its new climate economy project. Jacobs is convinced the decision to move away from mandates is a much better way to bring about lasting change.
In Kyoto, the world was trying to divide up a total amount of greenhouse gases, which it felt could be emitted by all countries in the world, and divide it up in some way fairly between all the different countries, which proved very difficult. And this time round, we're trying to do something very different, which is to say to every country, do what you can. And every country is now finding its own way of doing this. And it isn't being asked to take a target by the international community as a whole. So the United States is now embarked on its own emissions reduction plan, which is also achieving much better air quality and other economic goals, jobs and so on. And every country is now doing the same kind of exercise. And because it's now up to each country, you're getting much, much more buy-in from many more people within the economy. Businesses are saying, yes, we can do this. And so what the world is trying to do in Paris is to come together with all these national plans now and see whether they add up to enough. And if they don't, to try and then put themselves on a course to do more in the future. So in many ways, Kyoto was a kind of top-down international process in which countries were being asked to do things by others. Paris is a bottom-up process in which countries are saying, this is what we think we can do. Let's put these all together and let's try and achieve the global effort in that way.
Who decides what is enough and what would be the politics of that calculation?
Well, the scientists tell us what is enough to limit global warming, the rise in global temperature, to 2 degrees, which is what the international community has agreed. We should try not to cross that threshold. And so the scientists are then telling us, well, if you don't want to do that, then you are going to have to limit emissions over a long period, 50, 60, 70 years, to a certain amount. And that amount, we now have some idea what that is from the science. And so in a sense, what is now happening is that countries are putting forward their national plans, and then the scientists are saying, well, this is where we think you need to be, and there is a gap. And we know there is a gap between what countries are putting forward and what the scientists say we need to do to achieve this international goal. And so the Paris negotiations are about how can the world close that gap in the future. And that's the challenge that we now have in front of every country in the world.
How do we evaluate each individual country's good faith effort to say we're doing something, and are emitter countries like the United States and China held to different standards than countries that are, in a sense, victims of the consequences of climate change, you know, nations that are close to sea level?
We don't need to take this on good faith. The agreement will introduce rules and extend rules that we already have for how countries should report and monitor and verify their emissions. And this is, of course, already happening. So this is not just about future action. We know, for example, that China over the last 6 or 7 years has been reducing its emissions growth very, very considerably. There is a big distinction now between the countries that have major emissions and the countries that are primarily experiencing climate change, but whose own contribution to that process has been very small. So the least developed countries, the poorest countries in the world, produce almost no emissions of their own, but are already experiencing climate change very strongly. So part of this agreement that we're trying to reach in Paris is about how we can be fair.
How do you deal with what I'm dubbing the Volkswagen problem, where a country might behave very, very well during the Paris conference and in the years just afterwards, but then actually end up polluting quite a lot between now and the time the nations get together again?
When we last tried to do this at Kyoto, there was a very strong sense that this was all a burden, that trying to reduce emissions was basically a cost that we would all have to bear. And it might be a cost that we needed to bear because we were trying to solve a global problem. But nevertheless, it wasn't really something that was in our national self-interest, seen from our own perspective. That is no longer the case. What's really interesting now is that countries are acting on greenhouse gas emissions because it is in their interest to do so. So China, for example, is now cutting carbon coal out of its system at a rate much, much faster than we thought it would be doing, not primarily because of the climate benefits, although those are very important, but because coal produces local air pollutants which kill people and which cause terrible respiratory illnesses. And it's for that reason that China is now acting on its emissions. And that should give us great confidence that it will carry on doing so, because that's not about its obligations to the international community. It's about ensuring that its people are healthier.
So bearing on your experience in Bonn recently, what do you think the main political hot points are going to be in Paris or leading up to Paris?
So I think the core issue in Paris is, does the agreement bring in a regular process of review and improvement of the climate plans that countries have? So we've now got every country in the world, more or less, over 150 countries have now produced their national climate plans with their targets and policies for 2025 and 2030. But we know that more has to be done if we're to hold global warming to the 2 degrees, which the international community has said we must. And that means that in another 5 years' time, we're going to have to do this again with a new set of targets for 5 years further ahead, and perhaps to look again at the ones that we've already got. And that needs to happen every 5 years, so that there is a regular process of improvement and further ambition until we get down to the point at which we can feel confident that we are able to hold global warming to that 2 degrees. And that is the most important thing, I think, which needs to be agreed in Paris. A regular cycle of commitments where every country bears down on its emissions progressively over time.
Michael Jacobs is senior advisor to the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate, looking forward to the Paris talks on climate change and the agreement that will come after that UN climate conference. Thanks so much, Michael.
My pleasure. Many thanks.
Whatever the outcome in Paris, it will produce a lot of something. I'm not talking about carbon or methane. I'm talking about acronyms you should know. IPCC. That's easy. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It won a Nobel Peace Prize, along with Al Gore, whose name is a lot easier to remember. Coming up, we'll have Mr. Vice President.
The reality of the climate crisis has now sunk in. Even if they don't want to use the words, they know now that it's real, and they know we got to solve it.
And the takeaway is here to help you decode all the new words and acronyms the Paris Climate Summit negotiators, that is the COP21 participants, will be using. All you have to do is go to thetakeaway.org. We'll translate ADPs and the CMPs. You'll be able to impress your friends and explain to them why those parties to the UNFCCC are required to disclose their INDC. All true. Again, find a useful climate change glossary at thetakeaway.org. Al Gore is coming right up.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on stock market tips, storytelling, shaken cocktails, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
Who has a seat at the table in Paris? We are discussing the upcoming climate change conference with people who will be there officially or otherwise, and we are convening a conversation with you on the subject and trying to assess how much of what comes out of the conference can be practically implemented. Former Vice President Al Gore was part of the negotiations that led to the Kyoto Protocol back in 1997, an agreement the United States never ratified and whose goals for emission reductions remain elusive. But Gore's global leadership on this issue has continued despite any differences he may have with the U.S. government. 8 years ago, he was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize alongside the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for all of their efforts. Gore is now chairman of an organization called the Climate Reality Project, which has been lobbying for an agreement in Paris that would get maximum buy-in from the citizens of the world. He's observed a lot of changes throughout the years in how people are thinking about the climate crisis.
The predicted impacts of the climate crisis are now visible, and people are experiencing them viscerally. We've had 7 once-in-1,000-year downpours in the U.S. Just in the last few years. Every single day on the news, it's like a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. The droughts, including in California and in other places around the world, I won't list. The disruption of agriculture, the melting of ice, and the rising of sea levels. I was in Miami last month, and fish from the ocean were swimming in some of the streets on a sunny day because it was a high tide. And in Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale, many other places, that happens regularly. The second big change is the emergence of not only hope for solutions, but very tangible evidence that the electricity from solar and wind is going to be competitive everywhere in the world and already is in many places, as I mentioned. And the third change is we've been training people all over the world. Climate activists at the grassroots level in every country are really energized and contacting their elected officials, winning the conversations on the climate crisis all around them. We really are at a turning point.
Can China and the United States get together on this? Have you seen evidence of that?
Very definitely, John. Great question. In some ways, the key question, because China and the U.S. are the number one and number two polluters, respectively. And 1 year ago, President Obama and President Xi Jinping of China signed an historic agreement in Beijing that marked the first time that China has been willing to limit its emissions, put a cap on its emissions. There's a controversy right now about how much coal it's actually been burning, but they're moving very quickly away from coal. They're probably spending way more money than any other nation on solar and wind. And again, they've agreed to sign up to reductions, a limit on emissions, and then a reduction in emissions. So when China and the U.S. join with the European Union, which was already on side, then that creates a lot of momentum for the rest of the world. And some of these very low-income countries are seeing it very differently now, partly because of the factor I mentioned earlier. They're feeling the impacts, and they know something's got to be done.
Does it make you sad as an American to see China adopting cap and trade before the U.S.?
Makes me happy that China's adopting cap and trade. They're taking another number of other measures that I wish we would also take. But I'm proud that President Obama is moving aggressively in his second term to mandate reductions in CO2. I think that's all to the good.
What do you think is the most amazing political change in America and around the world from the awareness of climate change? And how do you think that's going to have an impact on the top-down discussions that will take place at the conference in Paris?
The biggest change in American politics that I've seen in my lifetime is the intrusion of big money. It's awful now. Our democracy has been hacked, John. The operating system no longer works for the American people. Big money writes the laws and the rules. And when they say jump, there are too many politicians that reflexively ask how high. And this change came about partly because of the rise of television as the principal medium. So now, unlike in the early days of our republic when the printing press offered easy access for the exchange of ideas, now they're gatekeepers, and politicians have to spend most of their time begging rich people and special interests for money so they can buy these god-awful 30-second TV ads. And that's where the main political conversation takes place in America now. And these ads are not the Federalist Papers. They're mostly negative. But the biggest harm is the fact that these candidates are all required to beg special interests for money. That's the biggest change. And it comes into play when we try to tackle a problem like the climate crisis, because a lot of people are not paying attention to it, but the carbon polluters are, and they use their campaign contributions and lobbying, and they go zipping through that revolving door between industry and government. And the whole thing gets twisted around. Now, to the point of your question, the reality of the climate crisis has now sunk in. People get it. There are still a few deniers out there, of course. There always will be. There are some people who still think the moon landing was fake. But the vast majority of people, even if they don't want to use the words, they know now that it's real. And they know we got to solve it. And that's why you're seeing so much progress in the lead up to this meeting in Paris. Every nation in the world will be sitting down at that table, hammering out the final disagreements. Most of the text is done already. This is going to be a success. We're going to get an agreement, and it's going to contribute to the tremendous change that's underway.
Al Gore, former vice president and chairman of the Climate Reality Project. Next this hour, we dial down our demographics. Coming up, a conversation about intergenerational equity, how climate change decisions really need to consider the impact on young people and generations to come. That's an important big idea that's being promoted by America's youth delegation in Paris.
Pushing for that specific phrase of intergenerational equity to be in the treaty text, which means that future generations are being considered when making decisions about policies and where collectively we're headed.
Youth delegate Maria Langholz next on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The decisions of 2015 on climate change will have consequences for generations unborn, and there will be no one at the table representing them in Paris. But the closest thing to a future generations delegation might be the thousands of youth delegates from around the world, including 22 from the United States. Many of these delegates will be allowed to sit right alongside the decision makers. They have no official role, although one could say young people have a greater stake in the outcome than the 50-somethings and above who will largely be hammering out this deal. Maria Langholz is co-leader of the U.S. youth delegation. It's called Sustain Us. The group has been sending delegations to UN climate negotiations for the last 10 years, long enough for Langholz to know how to be realistic about these things.
Even though we have that access, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have the ability to influence those decision makers. And I think that what I've really come to grasp about what our role is to be telling the story also outwardly to the broader world, to the U.S. youth climate movement, to our families, to folks who aren't right there in that space about what is happening and trying to really garner a sense of a growing movement and not being so dependent on the outcome of just this conference, but recognizing all of the other things that we need alongside an agreement to really make the change that we need.
That's great to hear. I mean, I have to ask you, though, what's it like to be at a conference where a bunch of old fogies are going to make decisions about stuff that will happen long after they're dead that you're going to have to live?
I mean, it's definitely a challenging thing. And I think that that's one of the reasons why we emphasize the need to be doing so much more than just being wrapped up in what the outcome of this agreement is. That, yes, this is something that is important. Yes, this does have the potential to set the trajectory of where we're going as a world. But that is not the only thing that we need. And also a lot of the things that are talked about on the international level will actually be implemented and realized on the local, state, and national level. And really knowing that we have the ability to push for something more ambitious when implementing what they're talking about internationally.
I mean, I sometimes say, half seriously to my kids, sorry we left the world in such a big mess. But in your case at this conference, I mean, you're going to really feel that tangibly.
Yeah, and I think that's actually one of the reasons that one of the main youth priorities at these UN negotiations for about the last 5 years has been on this idea of intergenerational equity, and that's one of our delegation priorities. So pushing for that specific phrase of intergenerational equity to be in the treaty text, which means that future generations are being considered when making decisions about policies and where collectively we're headed.
Well, I'm glad to learn of intergenerational equity. I can see it in a constitutional amendment as I think about it. Is that something you'd love to be involved with?
You're saying like at the federal level?
Sure. Put into the U.S. Constitution that there needs to be an intergenerational equity consideration in the passage of environmental laws and other laws.
I mean, that would be super rad. And I think would, like you said, not just be important in terms of climate and environment, but when we're talking about immigration policy, when we're talking about racial justice and all the other issues that I think are really at the forefront of where change needs to happen. And yeah, I think that really putting that into a more formalized law piece of legislation would be extremely beneficial to a lot of different fights we're in.
Well, you've got your work cut out for you if that's a part of your mission, but you would say that is super rad.
Yeah, super rad.
All right. Well, Maria, it's been a delight talking to you.
Cool. Thank you.
Maria Langholz is co-leader of Sustain Us. Negotiators gather at the United Nations climate talks in Paris this December. One thing you may not know is that an entire continent on planet Earth will not be represented. Heather Goldstone is science correspondent for WCAI and WGBH Radio. Welcome, Heather.
Good to be here.
They missed a continent? What?
A little surprising, huh? But it doesn't actually have its own population or government. So, yeah, Antarctica doesn't get its own delegation.
That's my guess. But that's a big issue. It's a big deal.
It is. In fact, Antarctica has been called a wild card because the entire continent is basically made of ice. And in extreme situations, if that were to all melt, it would add an enormous amount of water to the oceans that could add up to several meters of sea level rise.
So not represented. That's obvious. They wouldn't necessarily be represented. Nobody lives there except for scientists. But to not put it on the agenda officially?
Well, Antarctica definitely is part of what is, you know, when the UN's science body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, is setting the science stage for these negotiations and talking about what the future could look like, Antarctica is definitely in there. But it's maybe not represented as fully as it could be. And that's because to date, a lot of the science has been somewhat uncertain with regard to these worst case scenarios, whether we could see the entire continent melting or whether there would just be slightly faster melting as the air gets warmer, but nothing to really worry about. And because it's so uncertain and because what the IPCC has tried very explicitly to do is to be very conservative scientifically, they're not trying to necessarily go for these uncertain extreme scenarios.
We think of the IPCC report as the real solid, you know, scientifically based valid scenario of what's going to happen. But why would they be conservative about Antarctica here? That seems odd.
Well, it's simply that the science has been uncertain, that it seemed like these extreme scenarios of melting or destabilization on a widespread basis across Antarctica maybe could happen, but it didn't really seem necessarily plausible, or we didn't have the evidence to really support that. But as the science has progressed, it's becoming more and more certain. One example is a study that was just released. Sarah Das, one of the scientists on that, and also her postdoctoral researcher, Luke Trussell, looking specifically at one piece of the Antarctica puzzle. And that is, as the air warms, it warms the tops of these glaciers and ice shelves and starts to melt them from the top down. And they were looking at, under two different emission scenarios, either business as usual, keeping emitting carbon as we are doing, or else reducing carbon dioxide emissions, how much melting we might see this top-down melting. And they found that, in fact, regardless of what we do, by 2050, we'll probably see a doubling in that melting. But that if we curb our emissions, by 2100, we'll still be seeing accelerated melting. But most of the continent, the ice shelves around the edges, and these ice shelves are what protrude out over the water, that those would mostly still be stable. But that under a high emissions scenario, what we would see is actually widespread destabilization of those ice shelves. And as those start to collapse, that then frees the land-based glaciers to move more quickly into the ocean and start contributing to sea level rise. And the thing with this one study is it's one piece of the puzzle. But Luke Trussell, the lead author on this study, says that it's really part of a growing consensus that as we learn more, these worst-case scenarios are becoming more and more plausible.
There is a growing scientific consensus that some of these scenarios, perhaps some of the more alarming scenarios, are perhaps not as far-fetched as we might have thought previously.
Post-Paris, do you think Antarctica will take a more central role to the discussions about what has to happen, the targets, that sort of thing?
You know, I think the science is really rapidly evolving, and the IPCC science reports have to reflect what's been going on in the science community. So as they start the process for the next set of those, they're going to be including more of this science that's going on. This recent study, other studies showing rapid melting of both West and East Antarctica. And so I do think it will start to show up in the science, and that will trickle its way up to the negotiations gradually.
Heather Goldstone, science correspondent for WGBH and WCAI. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn something new every day with more than 20,000 lessons on stock market tips, storytelling, shaken cocktails, and more. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
What does a conversation on practical responses to climate change actually sound like? You may have had some of these conversations yourself without knowing it. Comments about the weather, some insulation you installed, an electric car purchase. The Paris conference will attempt to generate more of these conversations and actions on a larger scale. And this is something we are keen to showcase in the coming weeks as part of a collaboration with WBEZ's Heat of the Moment project. Who are the early adopters and responders anticipating just what a changed planet can do to all of our lives? Well, meet General Russell Honoré, who oversaw the evacuation of New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. That was a real education for this experienced Army officer.
Only about 15% of Americans actually dedicate much time to disaster preparedness. And if the predictions work over the next decade, the way scientists are talking, we're going to face major disasters. And unfortunately, the people that's going to be most affected are the elderly, the disabled, and the poor.
Brad Redrick worries about the disastrous effects of climate change on the south side of Chicago, an area that is predicted to face more intense rain events and floods as the planet warms. These two have been working to create a network of people who can be community responders as the climate and its impacts become less predictable.
With the way that the rain patterns have changed, that our intake system doesn't get rid of the water, and then based on how the water falls and whatnot, we could be flooded. And it happened in a neighborhood in the north of Chicago. So it's a real scenario there, for a possible scenario for a pretty good-sized flood.
What do you have to do on your own to prepare and to think smartly about the kinds of things that could happen?
You know, that's what I'm learning now, is just how to do this. It's been very difficult. I'm surprised. It seems like people get bored. It's hard to keep this exciting. And then not being an official, you know, I think they tend to even listen to you less.
It sounds to me, General, like Brad wishes he had a couple of stars on his shoulder to get people to listen to him.
The concept Brad has is one that worked in spite of what the media portrayed on who did what in New Orleans. Most of the people's lives that were saved by neighbors. Because government isn't good enough to immediately respond to a major disaster like a Katrina and a Sandy. And that's what Brad is up against in his community, trying to create community awareness. And the ultimate idea is you need to be prepared to be your own first responder. Take care of your neighbor, take care of your elderly relatives.
So, Brad, how do you be your own first responder?
Well, by first having your own plan set up, and then working close with your neighbors.
And when we evacuate, there should be no cars leaving that town with empty seats. The majority of people that died in New Orleans were from that vulnerable population, elderly, disabled, and poor. And you know what, John? We found them alone in their homes.
Have you ever had that experience, Brad, finding somebody home alone?
We had a neighbor that passed during the last big snowstorm in Chicago about 3 years ago. He went out to shovel his snow, and they found him a couple days later frozen in the snow.
You take that personally?
Absolutely. And so that impressed upon us the fact that we've got to build a database of who's around us, what their conditions are. Because of this initiative, I found a couple of my neighbors are bedridden. They're depending on services to come and take care of them. But if a snowstorm comes, the service people can't get to them, then who does it fall on?
And you got a map of who's a shut-in, who's not, who's doing what?
You know, we're working on that, designs on setting up something like that, block by block.
Who's in your network of responders?
Now, currently, our network of responders are basically block club leaders. See, the neighborhood that I live in was once highly organized. So these are people I didn't have to really convince them. They know kind of innately that this is something worthwhile.
What about neighborhood businesses?
We did have a grocery store in the neighborhood whose owner came to one of our meetings, and when we were talking about looters and keeping things under control, she told us if there was an event, that it was a disaster, an emergency requiring folks to get food, that we could break into her store and she would not prosecute. So that was real nice, a nice agreement to have. And then she ended up going out of business.
Oh, my goodness.
Unrelated, because there was a fire and the landlord was not good about fixing the store up and she just couldn't make it. See, part of this difficulty is due to the economy. In Chicago, we've been hit hard with a lot of closures of businesses and whatnot, a lot of foreclosed residences.
It sounds like, General, that Brad's facing a flood of economic malaise there in his neighborhood, sort of shuts the neighborhood down and makes people even more vulnerable and powerless. Any advice?
Oh, absolutely. He's got a passion for what he's doing. He knows why he's doing it. And with our FEMA region up there, I'll reach out to them to reach out to you, because we've got to optimize when we have a citizen like you that's helping drive this culture of preparedness in communities. Because I'm telling you, what's coming with the climate change and the impact of it, every community is going to need to be prepared. We've Absolutely. Got unforeseen issues coming with water problems, with impact of heat on crops. You know, when we have problems with crops, John, it drives up the price of food, create global problems.
Brad, do you have the general's number on your wall there next to the phone?
No, I don't.
Well, that's because who has phones on the wall anymore, right? You got your cell phone there. You got the general's number in your cell phone?
No, I didn't, but I'd like to get it.
We'll get it to you right here in a minute, Brad.
All right, to both of you, give a shout out to people around the country who are listening, how they can get into the same spirit that you two are into. General, you're used to snapping people to attention. You know that voice? You got that voice, don't you?
I got that voice. We can do that. Get
all right,
up,
let's do
move,
it.
Get ready, be prepared. Be your own first responder. Don't expect somebody else to come save you and your family. Do your job. Take care of your family.
Well, Brad and General Russell, Honoré, thanks so much.
Well, you're certainly
thanks,
welcome.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Brad. Let me in touch.
All right.
General Russell Honoré oversaw the evacuation of New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina, and Brad Redrick is the chairman of the Disaster Preparedness Initiative for zip code 60619.
Coverage of climate change on The Takeaway and WBEZ Chicago is part of a project called Heat of the Moment. There's more at wbez.org/heat. And support is provided in part by the Joyce Foundation, working to improve quality of life, promote community vitality, and achieve a fair society.
Part of what is so alarming about the consequences of climate change is that someday our vivid memories of an Earth that once was will be like little museums of imagination, places we can no longer go, no longer live, mountains no longer snow-capped, species extinct. A coalition of scientists, designers, and activists wants to prevent that. It all began when a New Yorker, Miranda Massey, realized after Hurricane Sandy in 2012 that she wanted a place to learn about climate change that was not a laboratory or some pop culture disaster movie. Her vision? A real museum all about climate in New York City for people with real questions to find real answers. Massey has teamed up with veteran climate scientist Cynthia Rosenzweig, a senior research scientist at NASA and Columbia University. Cynthia shares a piece of that 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore for co-authoring the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. The Climate Museum is due to open its doors in 2020. It will follow a museum now up and running in Hong Kong. The two museums will share the spotlight, and although they tell a sometimes grim story, director Miranda Massey says their very presence are a sign the planet, with humanity's help, is attempting to heal itself.
We're going to be all about success stories of the past, the present, and the future. And of course, we have to balance that with urgency. I think that will be the great challenge in the content of the museum. We have to inspire people with stories about solutions that are in progress and that have already worked and that will work, and the breakthroughs in technology that will move us and transition us into a clean energy economy. And of course, we also have to not candy coat the fact that this is an increasingly urgent set of concerns, and we have to act now and into the decades to come.
How do you see a museum as the ideal model for this kind of engagement and outreach that I suspect is going to have to go on long before you open the doors if you get there in 2020?
Well, first of all, we're not going to do nothing until 2020 when the ribbon is cut. In fact, we're already starting a pop-up exhibit for probably a year from now, next fall. And we're going to be engaging in community discussions around the museum. So it's going to be a very living, engaging museum, not just a pile of bricks somewhere. But at the same time, having a location, a venue, a wonderfully designed building to act as a magnet for the kinds of information, presentations, discussions that need to happen as we develop the climate solutions is very much the idea of the museum.
And do you think that showcasing success of either mitigation or reversal is going to give that kind of excitement? Or is it design, people that have come up with ingenious solutions, that's going to give that kind of excitement? Or is it just alerting people, ringing alarm bells, that's going to give people that kind of excitement?
I think it's a combination of all of those. I work on climate impacts, and for 30 years, I published my first peer-reviewed journal article on climate change impacts in 1985. And because I work with so many groups, both here in New York, in the country, and around the world, there is so much going on. Every group is taking this on board, saying, what can we do, and how can we get started? And it's really to capture that tremendous amount of action that's really out there on the ground already.
The research is pretty clear that if we focus only on news that is dire, people turn away. And we can get people to engage if we balance success stories and urgency.
But visually, how are you going to grab people? I mean, for instance, the Discovery Channel, you know, talks a lot about the oceans, but their ratings come when they do Shark Week, right? So in many ways, you're going to have to think smartly about what's going to find the audience where they are. And if I'm a, 17-year-old kid going into the museum, in an ideal circumstance, what would you hope that I could see that would really be memorable?
I think it'll be different for different people. We want to provide a multitude of ways in. So for that 17-year-old, it might be, and I may be painting with too broad a brush here, but it might be a really captivating interactive exhibit that allows her or him to design an energy policy for the U.S. in 2050 based on the cutting-edge modeling that's being done at places like the Earth Institute up at Columbia, and providing a range of options and allowing her to look at what happens if you eliminate nuclear power from the mix, to use just one example. Giving the 17-year-old a sense of agency and a sense of being engaged with a technology that she recognizes. That's one kind of exhibit we'll have. We can also imagine much more traditional museum exhibits telling the story of the science or the story of the scientists that have brought us to this point. That could be a much more historical narrative about discovery and the adventure of the first ice core samples being taken, for example. We can imagine art exhibits and debate events, debates, of course, within science and reasonable policy, that would attract a different kind of audience. So there's a huge public out there that's ready to be engaged. And our goal is to empower people to become engaged and to have conversations with each other that they aren't having now.
Visually, how do you envision an exhibit that would cause someone, say a young family, to change their own behavior, give up certain things? What if I did this differently or did more of this?
First, we're working with the best designers in the New York area and the world to help us answer that question. As scientists, we're often accused of what you can't, you scientists can't communicate very well. So that's one of the reasons for my own engagement with the museum, because we have to build out from the base of the science and technology to actually do this kind of engagement. So this kind of interactive, what about having a playhouse in which that family can go inside a house and see and play with actually tactilely what kind of heating system, what kind of climate resilience against flooding for the extreme precipitation events, which are already occurring, and how they can link to their neighborhoods. Because individuals are very important, but also building out to neighborhoods, communities, and seeing what can be done in the groups that we are all part of as well.
And that's a fundamental part of the theory for the museum, is a very clunky academic term that is, quote, collective efficacy, unquote. And that's really just the self-fulfilling prophecy that happens when you realize, hey, if I change out all my own light bulbs on an individual basis, that's not solving the crisis. But if I'm part of a group effort that extends far beyond my own household and even beyond my own immediate community, then we absolutely can solve this problem that seemed intractable 10 minutes ago.
Miranda Massey is director of the upcoming Climate Museum, and Cynthia Rosenzweig is a senior research scientist at NASA and Columbia University. And here's one last thing to take with you today. We've been warned, folks, about climate change, that is, as early as 1907. Quote, "The conservation of natural resources is the fundamental problem. Unless we solve that problem, it will avail us little to solve all others." That was U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt, who loved to shoot stuff he would find in the wilderness. But it was Lyndon Johnson who officially warned Americans about carbon levels. He said this 50 years ago, just a few weeks after his inauguration. "Within a few short centuries, we are returning to the air a significant part of the carbon that was extracted by plants and buried in the sediments during a half a billion years." President Johnson was a real softy for nature. In 1965, he spoke at a White House conference on natural beauty.
"The technology which has given us everything from the computer to the teleprompter has created 100 sources of light. Poisons and chemicals pollute our air and our water. Automobiles litter our countryside. These and other waste products of progress are among the deadliest enemies that natural beauty has ever known."
We'll be covering all of the natural and unnatural beauty at the upcoming Paris Summit 50 years after Lyndon Johnson gave that speech. Until then, thanks for listening. This is The Takeaway.
PRI. Public Radio International.